From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. In 1961, an integrated group of civil rights activists rode by bus through the Deep South challenging segregation. Pledged to nonviolence, they remained undeterred by firebombing, beatings, and imprisonment. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Raymond Arsenault, author of Freedom Riders, which is now out in paperback. Also, critic-at-large John Powers tells us about his vote for the greatest movie about L.A., Killer of Sheep, an independent film made in the 70s about a family in Watts. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the latest Spider-Man sequel, Spider-Man 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. 46 years ago, an integrated group of self-proclaimed freedom riders challenged segregation by riding together on buses through the Deep South. They demanded unrestricted access to segregated buses, as well as to bus terminal restaurants and waiting rooms. The freedom riders were pledged to nonviolence and kept that pledge even when attacked and bloodied by their racist opponents. Today's guest, Raymond Arsenault, has written a memoir about those historic civil rights confrontations. His book, called The Freedom Riders, is now out in paperback. Before we listen to his interview with Terry, let's begin with an excerpt from another of Terry's interviews. In 1985, she spoke with James Farmer, one of the co-founders of the Freedom Riders, and of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Farmer recalled a turning point for the Freedom Riders when the group with which he was traveling was arrested in Mississippi.
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other freedom riders followed the two of us and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my CORE staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting freedom riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away. And then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place. And that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference. So that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was, I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old freedom ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the freedom ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett." He was the governor of Mississippi. "My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. And I'll stick to the freedom ride till every battle's won." Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could, and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut, and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other freedom riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while, until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul. And then one freedom rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this freedom rider shouted, "Come get my mattress. I'll keep my soul." And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time, I have to laugh when I think of this. One freedom rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us boy, you boys. He said, "Why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men." Another one reminded him that that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over and everything was floating in the water in our cells. One of the freedom riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
The late James Farmer, talking with Terry Gross about the Freedom Riders in a 1985 interview. Now to Raymond Arsenault. He's the author of Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The book, now out in paperback, is part of the Oxford University Press series Pivotal Moments in American History. Arsenault is a professor of Southern history at the University of South Florida. Terry spoke with him last year.
Raymond Arsenault, welcome to Fresh Air. We heard James Farmer describing that the Freedom Riders didn't want to be bailed out of the Parchman prison. What was the philosophy behind that jail-no-bail approach they took?
This was one of the most controversial innovations of the Congress of Racial Equality. There had been talk about jail-no-bail for years in the late 1950s, but no one had either marshaled enough courage or audacity to try it on any kind of mass level. And the first jail-no-bail actually took place in Tallahassee, Florida. A young activist named Patricia Stevens and several other activists decided to take Gandhian philosophy literally and to fill the jails as best they could. And then there was another jail-no-bail incident in Rock Hill, South Carolina in early 1961. And this gave the CORE, or Congress of Racial Equality, leaders hope that this could become kind of standard operating procedure in the movement. But the Freedom Rides was really the first time that this was tried on any kind of mass level.
Why was it controversial within the civil rights movement?
It seemed to go against common sense. It seemed counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people. Thurgood Marshall made a famous statement in Nashville when he was lecturing at Fisk, and he was criticizing the jail no bail, and he said, "For God's sake, if somebody can get you out, get out. Take the offer. Anybody who knows what it's like to be in a southern jail, to be a black person or even a white person who's a dissenter in jail, knows it's a very dangerous place to be." So Marshall was taking perhaps the more pragmatic view, but jail no bail became a badge of honor and a elemental strategy for CORE during the early 1960s.
Was it a troublesome mood for the prison authorities because they had to deal with all of these civil rights activists who were being very disruptive to the prison system?
I think it was very confounding for them. They were accustomed to intimidating people, to particularly young people. They had all kinds of ways of manipulating and threatening and in many cases actually physically harming people. And you know, southern jails, and particularly southern prisons, Parchman being the most notorious, but even the county jails and the city jails, they weren't accustomed to people trying to stay inside the bars. And so it defied logic for them, and they didn't know quite how to deal with it. And never, I think, really figured out a way to counter the tactics of these pesky kids and their allies.
So when the Freedom Riders refused to post bail, how did they get out of prison?
Well, in the case of most of the Freedom Riders who ended up behind bars in Mississippi, more than 300 ended up in Parchman Prison, there was a quirk of Mississippi law which said you had to get out before 40 days to be able to file an appeal. And, of course, ultimately what the Congress of Racial Equality and the Freedom Riders and the other organizations involved wanted to do was to create a test case to force the legal justice system, if possible, at the local and state level, but at least at the federal level, to endorse and to sustain and protect their constitutional rights. So they needed these appeals. So they would stay in for 39 days, but they would get out on time so that they could file their appeals in the Mississippi case. And almost all the southern states had some quirks like this. Part of the game in the Freedom Rides between the white segregationists and the Freedom Riders was a test of resources. They kept increasing the bond that they had to post. They tried to break the civil rights movement financially. They knew that resources were limited and that most of those resources were with the NAACP, which had an ambivalent attitude towards the Freedom Rides, that there was a feeling that by going into prison on a mass level was subjecting the civil rights movement to a lot of pressure, making it more vulnerable, that the Freedom Rides was an enormous gamble, that if all this money was poured into it and there were no positive results, then this movement would be set back, that it would not advance. So there were a lot of people within the movement who had very serious questions about the wisdom of playing this very dangerous game.
Raymond Arsenault, speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with professor and author Raymond Arsenault. His book about the Freedom Riders, an integrated group of civil rights activists in the early 1960s, is now out in paperback.
The Freedom Riders were challenging segregation on interstate bus rides. Now, the buses had long been the center of protests in the South. Why were buses at the center of civil rights actions throughout the 20th century?
Well, there was an ongoing debate among civil rights activists as to where to place stress on the move for desegregation. Where should they begin? Should they begin with the schools? Should they begin with public housing? Should they begin with unemployment or employment policies? Should they begin with transportation? And there was no consensus on this matter. They were fighting on all fronts. But the buses and the trains and streetcars were a daily irritant for blacks. So it was a natural place where people would file lawsuits, where they would try to test the limits of Jim Crow culture. And this was particularly true in the 1940s when people began to have sort of individual freedom rides. They didn't use that term, but there were a number of people who challenged the Jim Crow conventions. Jackie Robinson, 1944, refused to move to the back of the bus near Fort Hood in Texas, and he was court-martialed. He was eventually exonerated, but that was just one example of an African-American who was not willing to put up with this.
Now, the initial group of freedom riders that CORE organized was basically hand-picked. I mean, you almost had to audition to be part of it. Why were they so carefully selected?
CORE had a philosophy of using a vanguard of carefully trained, disciplined, nonviolent activists who would not strike back no matter what happened. They felt that this was absolutely crucial, that you needed people who understood the responsibilities of nonviolence. They were terrified that if undisciplined activists were provoked, it would turn into violence and the cause of the movement would be set back. So they were very carefully chosen. There were several dozen applicants, and they had to be vouchsafed by ministers, by employers. If they were under 21, they had to get their parents' signature. They had to explain why they wanted to go on the Freedom Ride and that they were willing to follow the orders of CORE. This was an extremely important part of the strategy of the original Freedom Ride.
And did that careful selection continue through the history of the Freedom Riders?
It actually didn't continue exactly the way they hoped it would. There were ultimately 436 Freedom Riders, a remarkably diverse group of people. It was intergenerational, it was interregional, it was interracial. The pace of events dictated trying to fill the buses, to fill the jails in Mississippi, to maintain the pressure, to convince Southern segregationists that the Freedom Riders were not going to go away. So there were instances where people got on the Freedom buses without being carefully screened. And there were a couple of cases where Freedom Riders turned on each other with recriminations. It was an enormously difficult thing to organize, to administer. The civil rights movement was just emerging as a national phenomenon. They'd never tried to do anything on this scale before. You had several organizations, CORE, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Nashville Movement, the NAACP, Fellowship of Reconciliation. Getting all these people to be on the same page and to make sure that there were no provocateurs, that there weren't FBI informers, or Klan informers, or people who were not working in the best interest of the Freedom Rides. It was not easy to maintain the discipline, and I think in general they were remarkably successful in doing so. There were relatively few incidents, but it didn't have the purity of the original ride, certainly in the later stages.
It was the job of the Freedom Riders to remain nonviolent in spite of whatever anyone tried to do to provoke them. What were some of the violent acts directed against them that they had to endure?
Well, of course, the most famous violent acts were the bombing of a bus in Anniston, Alabama, where the Freedom Riders, the original Freedom Riders, one group of them, there was an attempt to burn them alive. In the bus, they were attacked by a mob of Klansmen, actually both men, women, and children dressed in their Sunday best. It was a horrific episode, which I think really scarred many of the people who endured it, who survived it. Then, of course, the other bus that had been sent from Atlanta got to Birmingham, and there had been collusion between the Commissioner of Public Safety, Bull Connor, and the police department, and several claverns of the Ku Klux Klan. And there was a Klan mob which attacked the riders as soon as they got to the Birmingham station. There were, of course, later attacks in Montgomery. After that, the civil rights movement sort of decided they had to take a stand, that they could not allow the violence in Alabama to end the Freedom Riders in failure. And so Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders flew into Montgomery to hold a rally in First Baptist Church, Reverend Ralph Abernathy's church. The church was surrounded by a mob of several thousand white supremacists. There was a fear that they actually were going to burn the church to the ground. This was all in front of a number of reporters and television cameras. Eventually, Governor John Patterson, who was a committed segregationist, but decided to mobilize the National Guard at the last minute to save the church and to save the Freedom Riders and their allies. And of course, this is what this episode in Montgomery on May 21st, 1961, is what drew the Kennedy administration into the fray. They had to send several federal marshals to try to mitigate the situation.
Raymond Arsenault speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. We'll hear more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with Raymond Arsenault about the Freedom Riders of the Civil Rights Movement. John Powers tells us about a 1970s film that has resurfaced, a hauntingly poetic portrait about family life in Watts, and David Edelstein reviews the third in a series of Spider-Man films. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Let's rejoin Terry's conversation with Raymond Arsenault, the author and professor who has written a book about his experiences in the civil rights movement as a young man. Now out in paperback, it's called Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Terry spoke with Raymond Arsenault last year.
What did the FBI do about the Freedom Riders and about the white supremacists who were attacking them and the Southern police and sheriffs who weren't doing much to protect the Freedom Riders?
One of the important sub-themes of the Freedom Rides is the role of the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover had no sympathy for civil rights activists. He was an avowed segregationist supporter of the status quo, and he he sent that message down to the FBI, and he, basically the FBI in the southern scene, they were note takers. They observed. They often knew what was about to happen, and of course, they had advanced information about the bus burning in Anniston and the mob gathering in Birmingham. But this information was not forwarded to the rest of the Justice Department. And from that day on, Robert Kennedy was not able to trust J. Edgar Hoover, even though Hoover had continued to have enormous power, and he and Kennedy had an interesting back-and-forth relationship. This was a major turning point in the sense that the FBI could not be trusted. But ironically, many white Southerners thought the FBI was part of the federal government and many times was in cahoots with the civil rights activists. And General John Patterson in Alabama actually threatened to arrest any FBI agent who interfered on behalf of the Freedom Riders.
In your book about the Freedom Riders, you described the Kennedy administration as initially seeing the Freedom Riders as a distraction from what the Kennedy administration really wanted to deal with at the time, which wasn't the civil rights movement, it was the Cold War. It was Cuba. It was the Soviet Union. So would you describe a little bit the Kennedy administration's take on the Freedom Rides and how they initially handled it?
Both the President John Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy, initially at least, and for a long time, considered the Freedom Rides to be a very disturbing distraction. The Cold War was at its height. The Freedom Rides came just after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. John Kennedy was just about to go on his first international summit meeting in Vienna. He had Khrushchev to deal with. The building of the Berlin Wall was imminent. The world seemed to be coming apart at the seams, and he did not want strife in the streets of Alabama to be on the front page. There was a strong sense among the Kennedys and many other Americans that what the Freedom Riders were doing was disloyal, that even though they may have admired their courage, they questioned their wisdom. And there were very very often charges of disloyalty. Why couldn't the Freedom Riders wait for a better time? Couldn't they see that there was a deeper agenda of countering the propaganda of the Soviet Union, of making the United States look bad on the international scene? And of course, what all this had to do with was the changed situation with respect to the decolonization of the Third World. Suddenly, people of color had an important part to play in the balance of power in the world. And the civil rights leaders, particularly those involved in the Freedom Rides, sensed this, that they could use this as a lever, as a way of saying, you know, if you want to claim a legitimacy to American democracy and to spread it abroad, then you've got to live up to your own ideals at home.
So, what action did the Kennedy administration take when the Freedom Riders were being jailed and beaten?
The Kennedy administration, at first, they sent John Siegenthaler, who was a native of Nashville, Tennessee, a personal representative of both the president and the attorney general, down to try to make sure that the Freedom Riders stayed, the original Freedom Rides stayed alive. He flew with them when they gave up traveling from Birmingham to Montgomery by bus. He flew with them on the Freedom plane from Birmingham to New Orleans. And both he and the other administration officials thought that was the end of it. What they didn't realize is that there was a band of student activists, the Nashville Movement students, followers of Reverend Jim Lawson, who decided the Freedom Ride could not end this way. They could not allow the core riders to be chased out of Alabama, to flee by plane. And it was a disappointing end for the original Freedom Ride. So the student activists in Nashville and other movement centers in the South said, we can't let it end this way. So they organized another set of Freedom Rides, which was a terrible turn of events for the Kennedys. Said, oh my God, the crisis is reheating. Now we've got all these students threatening to come into Birmingham. So that's how it restarts, and it just won't go away. By the end of May, Bobby Kennedy decides to turn to the Interstate Commerce Commission to beg them to pass a sweeping desegregation order. Now, he knew this would take weeks and even months, and in fact, he doesn't get his order until September 22nd, 1961, and it's not effective until November 1st. And of course, even though the civil rights activists, the freedom riders, appreciated what Kennedy was doing, they did not adhere to his call for a cooling off period. They said, we've been cooling off for a century. We're not going to cool off anymore. We want freedom now. We want you to prove to us that the ICC will render a sweeping desegregation order. So that's why the freedom riders continue to board the buses and to continue to have these freedom rides throughout the summer. And more people get involved as they come mostly into Jackson, Mississippi, and ultimately to Parchman Prison.
Raymond Arsenault speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with civil rights activist, professor, and author Raymond Arsenault.
And one of the things you write about in your book about the Freedom Riders is how the media covered the riders and what the impact the media coverage had. And something I found really surprising in your discussion of the media is what you write about David Brinkley. You write, David Brinkley editorialized that the Freedom Riders are, quote, accomplishing nothing whatsoever and, on the contrary, are doing positive harm. The result of these expeditions are not of benefit to anyone, white or Negro, the North or the South, nor the U.S. in general. We think they should stop it. Where did he say this?
David Brinkley did a commentary on the NBC Nightly News. He, of course, was from North Carolina. I think considered himself to be a moderate liberal, certainly someone who didn't normally endorse Jim Crow segregation, but he felt that the Freedom Riders were being unreasonable. And he was not alone in this. There were a number of sort of many mainstream journalists who were supported by the public opinion polls. In general, more than two-thirds of Americans, although they supported the ideal of desegregation in most cases, rejected the tactics of the Freedom Riders. And Brinkley was speaking for them, suggesting that there was something unpatriotic about what the Freedom Riders were doing by not recognizing the damage that they were doing to America's reputation, to its image around the world. And he felt that they simply were naive, that they were provocateurs, that they were largely young kids who didn't know what they were doing. Furious at them, as many Americans were, because they would not allow the United States to go back to business as usual until the problems that they were addressing were paid attention to.
You found a lot of former Freedom Riders for your book, you know, as part of your research. Is there anything, any kind of observation that nearly every Freedom Rider you spoke to shared? Is it something that they all had in common about the way they saw the Freedom Rides?
You know, I've often said that the Freedom Rides showed that ordinary people could do extraordinary things, but after working 10 years on this book, I really don't believe that these are or were ordinary people. There were 436 of them. They took amazing risks, displayed extraordinary courage in the face of widespread censure. I mean, their own families, in many cases, telling them that they were doing things that were making them ashamed, that they were making the mistake of their lives, that they were being unreasonable, that they were going down a road that would hurt themselves and hurt the nation, and how they stayed the course, how they kept their eyes on the prize, is sometimes beyond me. Oftentimes historians, when they dig deeper into a topic, when they see the real historical figures, it can be kind of disillusioning. That's not what happened here. The deeper I probed, the more respect I had for them. And I'm in awe, really, not only of what they did in 1961, but what many of them have continued to do. They've really dedicated their lives to social justice, and it's just an incredibly empowering message, it seems to me.
Among the people who you interviewed who had been freedom riders, did any of them have scars, and I don't mean emotional scars, I mean physical scars, or disabilities from beatings that they had taken during the freedom rides? And if so, how do they regard those scars or disabilities now?
There were a number of freedom riders who emerged with physical scars. Most of them are dead now. Walter Bergman, who was a white freedom rider from Michigan who was nearly beaten to death in the original freedom ride, eventually filed a lawsuit where he won a kind of a nominal judgment against the FBI for its complicity for an FBI informer in the beating. He lived to be 99, despite he was in a wheelchair most of the rest of the years of his life. William Barbie, one of the most poignant of the riders, who was the advance scout into Montgomery. He was attacked at the bus station in Montgomery, and they stuck a jagged piece of metal into his temple. He never recovered, and he lived 20 more years, but was never the same. Ed Blankenheim, a rider that I interviewed at great length, a white rider who died last year in San Francisco, had been a carpenter and a part-time student at the University of Arizona. The joke among the freedom riders, even though he was a secular rider, was that, as Hank Thomas, one of the other riders, said, Jesus sent us a carpenter from Arizona. Ed suffered a stroke later in his life. It was in part a result of some of the things that he experienced in the rides. But they wear them as badges of honor. I can't tell you how many times the freedom riders have told me, often with tears in their eyes, that this was the moment of their lives. At the time, even though they were being told they were making a mistake, they now know that this was whatever else they did in their lives, whatever injuries they suffered, that their lives made a difference. They didn't get everything they wanted. Some of the ideals have not been realized, but they stood up for justice at a critical moment in American history when relatively few people were willing to do so. And so whatever injuries they suffered, and they certainly did suffer them, they wore them, I think, and continue to wear them as a badge of honor.
Raymond Arsenault, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Raymond Arsenault, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His book about the civil rights struggle of the early 1960s, Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice, is now out in paperback. It's taken 30 years for Charles Burnett's acclaimed film Killer of Sheep to get a theatrical release. Set in Watts in the late 70s, it presents a slice of African-American life that critics have called both despairing and hopeful. Our critic at large, John Powers, finally gets a chance to review it.
A few years ago, an L.A. newspaper asked me to name the best movie ever made about Los Angeles. There were lots of world-famous contenders, of course. Sunset Boulevard with its fabulous title and unforgettable swimming pool. Chinatown with its incestuous history lesson. And Blade Runner with those rainy noodle shops and eloquent replicants. But there was one problem. Nearly all the trademark L.A. films are steeped in the myths of film noir. They're more concerned with an idea of Los Angeles than the reality of life as it's lived here. That's why I decided that the greatest movie about L.A. was Killer of Sheep, Charles Burnett's hauntingly poetic portrait of one family's daily existence in and around Watts. Made in the 1970s for a mere $10,000, this masterpiece also just happens to be the finest film yet made about African-American life. But even though it was one of the first 50 films chosen for protection through the Library of Congress's National Film Registry, you couldn't see it anywhere until now. Henry Gale Saunders stars as Stan, the film's title character, who works at a Watts slaughterhouse. While the job supports his family, Stan's worn down by the cruel nature of his work and by a nagging sense of futility. He has trouble sleeping, rebuffs his wife's affections, and he seems cut off from his kids, who spend the movie doing the things that kids do, yelling, sobbing, building forts, riding bicycles recklessly, and in one scene of astonishing loveliness, they leap from one apartment building rooftop to the next. They look like angels brought down to the earth to frolic. But there's no flying away from these dispiriting, sun-lashed streets, with their dilapidated houses, bombed-out buildings, predatory shopkeepers, and easygoing crooks who don't understand why Stan doesn't just wise up and join in their crimes. After all, God gave man fists for a reason. But Stan has his pride, as is clear in this scene when a friend asks him about buying a car.
What do you want with another raggedy-ass car for, huh?
Trying to get ahead, man.
You niggas are sick. Now you think you're middle class.
Man, I ain't poor. Look, I give away things to the Salvation Army. You can't give away nothing to the Salvation Army if you poor. I mean, we may not have a damn thing sometimes. You want to see somebody that's poor?
Mm-hmm.
Now you go around and look at Walters. Now, he'd be sitting over an oven and with nothing but a coat on and sitting around there rubbing their knees all day and eating nothing but wild greens picked out of a vacant lot. No, that ain't me. And damn sure won't be. And tomorrow after I cash my check, let's go over to Sybil's and buy that motor and put it in.
Right on.
Killer of Sheep was Burnett's MFA thesis film. I suspect he passed. And it showed him already to be a mature artist in his 20s. He doesn't share the hipsterism that defines so much indie film, nor is he a provocateur like better-known African-American directors, such as Spike Lee or John Singleton. His work is actually far more daring, because it violates our expectations of what black filmmaking is or can be, not without a cost to his career. Although he's worked often and well over the last 25 years, his most famous film is probably To Sleep With Anger, he's never really been commercial. In no small part because he refuses to play with the usual clichés. As he once remarked, black filmmakers are the only ones whose work is considered realistic when it's demeaning. Burnett works in a style that recalls international art films. It contains echoes of Rossellini, Bresson, and Ozu. But his subject matter is steeped in the facts of American life. Killer of Sheep shows us profound truths about race, work, and the spiritual cost of poverty. Truths no less stingingly relevant today than three decades ago. Political but not doctrinaire, he doesn't sentimentalize or demonize anybody. Instead, he shows life's radiant complexity in the violent beauty of kids throwing stones in the street, or a woman zinging a would-be Lothario with the joyously disdainful put-down, "You bout as tasteless as a carrot." In one exquisite scene, the exhausted Stan embraces his young daughter as his wife looks on. Wounded that just seconds before, he's again rejected her romantic overtures. For all his clear-eyed vision, Burnett possesses what may be the rarest quality in American film, tenderness. It shines through the film's memorable black-and-white images, now restored to a splendor I've never before seen, in his delicate handling of an amateur cast, and in his richly expressive use of music, from Louis Armstrong's la-da-da warble on West End Blues to Dinah Washington's ravishing version of This Bitter Earth. The song plays over the fatalistic final scene when Stan, doing the slaughterhouse job that keeps his family alive, leads sheep to their inevitable doom. It's just one measure of Burnett's compassionate brilliance that he understands how killers and sheep can become one and the same.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Here's Dinah Washington.
Lord, this bitter earth. Yes, can be so cold. Today, you're young. Too soon, you're old. But while a voice within me cries, I'm sure someone may answer my call. And this bitter earth, so bitter after all.
Coming up, David Edelstein on Spider-Man 3. This is Fresh Air. In 1962, Marvel Comics introduced the character of Spider-Man, a teenage crime fighter with spider-like superpowers. 4 decades later, The Amazing Spider-Man became an amazing cinematic blockbuster, directed by Sam Raimi. Now comes Spider-Man 3, the latest sequel, and, reportedly, the most expensive movie ever made. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Some grown-ups I know complain about the relentless tide of $100, $200, $300 million comic book superhero sequels every summer. So it's worth pointing out that whatever you think of them, they're not all mindless escapism. Some are this generation's religious parables. The last Superman movie, Superman Returns, explicitly linked the Man of Steel to Christ, bearing the sins of mankind on his broad, but not that broad, shoulders. The new Spider-Man 3 is practically a Ben-Hur for our time, a film that delivers state-of-the-art spectacle, but also throws a spotlight on its hero's struggle between good and evil, that ends in deathbed conversions and churchy epiphanies, and that offers more homilies than the average Sunday sermon. I don't want to sound churlish. So many of its bits are exuberant, and its special effects are a wow. It's an embarrassment of riches. But it's also flabby and overinflated. It doesn't have the snap of the last two Spider-Man movies, in which director Sam Raimi proved a whiz at mixing pop and torment. In the first, he toyed with real adolescent confusions, as the nerdy Peter Parker, played by Tobey Maguire, had to cope with sudden bodily eruptions, as well as his love for the beauteous Mary Jane, played by Kirsten Dunst. What marred the movie was how this very grounded protagonist suddenly morphed into a computer-generated video game figure swinging through a cartoony cityscape. But the sequel was a triumph. The villain, played by the soulful Alfred Molina, had real dramatic stature, and it was amusing and affecting to watch a hero so conflicted that neither side, human or superhuman, functioned properly. Peter's Spider-Man 3 trajectory is more of a slog. At the start, Spidey is a big celebrity, and Peter is so darn happy. It's lovely when he and Mary Jane, now his girlfriend, lie on a web high over Central Park and gaze at a meteor shower, talking of her recent Broadway debut and smooching.
Wow. Mm. Did you see that one?
You know what? I'd like to sing on stage for the rest of my life with you in the first row.
I'll be there.
Tell me you love me.
I love you. I love you so much. I always have.
This is the cue for the crash of a meteor that bears black sticky stuff with legs, a blob with no apparent purpose except to attach itself to Peter and bring out his supposed dark side. Our hero becomes more self-centered, more prone to anger and vengeance. The charcoal black Spider-Man that emerges is pretty cool looking, and the ostentatiously hip, black-clad Maguire brings off some snazzy funny moves in a jazz club. He's like Jerry Lewis's Buddy Love in The Nutty Professor. But Spidey's dark night of the soul is very vanilla. He doesn't do anything particularly mean or destructive. The filmmakers take up the slack with 3 supervillains. Harry Osborn, played by James Franco, still bent on vengeance for his father, the Goblin's, death. Venom, played by Topher Grace, a jerky photographer who gets black-slimed. And most memorably, the Sandman, played by Thomas Hayden Church. He's an escaped con, accidentally pulverized in a particle physics lab. He has to practice in an exquisite sequence, holding together the millions of grains that constitute and reconstitute his body. The clashes between Spider-Man and his foes still look a tad video game-esque, but who cares with all these rock'em sock'em new permutations? They're dazzling, and they should be at these prices. And hey, today's kids have more incentive than ever to study math and physics. They can devise better CGI superhero battles. But the climactic battle is a big porridge of stunts and effects. I lost count of the times Dunst plunges from a building, enough to make you think, put her on the ground or let her fall already. With all these bad guys, the movie never builds any momentum. The script is full of dead spots, like the sermons of old Aunt May, played by Rosemary Harris. The bloat and the religiosity made me nostalgic for the days when comic books were nerdy and disreputable, rather than overstuffed tales of spiritual anguish. There's so much to love in Spider-Man 3. I just wish its hero were more concerned with saving falling bodies than fallen souls.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for NPR comes from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or EndlessPool.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Gary Shandling. He's got a new DVD box set out collecting the best of The Larry Sanders Show, but also offering an entirely different brand new series as a bonus. Join us for the next Fresh Air.